Christmas is a time of year for smart alecks to prove that they know more than everyone else. Okay, let me demonstrate. Okay, maybe you've heard someone saying things like this. The 25th of December isn't really Jesus' birthday. Yeah, anyone heard that before? I'll just run through these other ideas that I've heard. You can put up the title slide, Jim. Jesus wasn't really born in a stable. We don't know how many wise men actually came to see him. The year was probably 3 BC, not 1 AD. Christmas began as a pagan festival. Or Christmas didn't begin as a pagan festival. Just have a debate and an argument about that. And then there's always that person who wants to point out that the night was not silent as Jesus was born. But don't allow those details and the people that want to make an argument out of that distract you from the importance of the Christmas story. God clothed himself with humanity in the form of a baby. That's a history-changing event, and we move on too quickly. If we move on too quickly, we overlook and miss out on something that is very important to our faith. The Gospels of Matthew and Luke give us records of Jesus' birth, and yes, we could talk about them at any time of year. But it makes sense to talk about them at this time of year, doesn't it? There are aspects of the story where it would be helpful to have more information. I mean, Matthew and Luke could have just cut out that whole debate by not only telling us that there were three gifts, but also there were three men bringing those gifts. Or that there were 13 men bringing three gifts, or whatever it was. It's like, can we have some more information, please, Matthew? Luke, Mark, why didn't you include it? John, did you cover that in your class the first week? Why wasn't there a birth narrative in Mark? He could have just addressed so many questions. Matthew, though, doesn't begin his story with the birth of Jesus. Matthew begins his story of Jesus with a genealogy. I know, it's thrilling, isn't it? It's like getting the credits to a movie at the start of the movie. And we all know how exciting the credits are, right? Only these, you know how when you watch the credits of a movie, and sometimes they put the bloopers in there, and you stay at the movie because someone told you that there were going to be bloopers, and so you sit through the credits just for the bloopers. Matthew, I think, is kind of doing that for us. I'll flesh that out in just a moment. He begins with this genealogy. And there are a few reasons for doing this, but the main reason, I believe, is that he connects Jesus to the rest of the story. And I think as Christians, sometimes we want to say, well, Jesus is the center of our story. And Jesus is the center of our story, but sometimes, I believe, practically, we make Jesus the start of our story. And in doing that, we really miss out on what goes before. That Jesus is the middle of the story. That God has been working in history, working among his people, working to redeem people and bring them into relationship with him since the very beginning of time. And so the story of Jesus isn't a new thing. It's a continuation of an old thing. And the genealogy that is put there at the beginning of Matthew reminds us that Jesus is just perhaps the most important link in the chain, but nonetheless another link in the chain that connects humanity to God. And so we have these lists of generations between Jesus all the way back to Abraham. And so one notable aspect of this genealogy is that in addition to Jesus' mother, Mary, and we just read a prayer by Mary, a song, a prayer by Mary, and it's a wonderful prayer that talks of how God has lifted up the humble, how God, it closes with how God has shown mercy to Israel, how God has brought down the proud. And so Matthew, I think, has the same theme as he goes through, because he lists four other women in this genealogy. And I think that if we look through it, we look at this list of names, and so many of them we don't know. They're like the credits. Okay? The third person walking on the street. Okay? The waiter. You know, it just shows the waiter, and then it has his name. Or, you know, female cop. Yeah? And you're like, oh, yeah, was there a female cop? Yeah. And so we have this list of names, and we don't know who most of them are. But every so often, as you go through those movie credits, there's that blooper, that scene that they add in there. And you go, oh, that's interesting. And so Matthew does this as he goes down through this list of names. More so, you can see there towards the beginning, you don't have to read them all, but you can see in yellow at the end that he includes these four women. And these four women are like the little vignettes, they're not bloopers in the sense of we know them, but little scenes from the story of history that fill in some gaps, that capture our attention. They stand out because they're different. This 14, 14, and 14 series of groups of 14, three 14s as we go through this genealogy. So that gets us to about 42 men in that list. There's gaps. I mean, that's not the exact link from each person, but the 14 are to show has a significance. But out of those 42 men, there are four women, and they're noteworthy. But why these four? Why is Matthew telling? What is Matthew telling us by including the names Tamar, Rahab, Ruth, and then Bathsheba, not even by name, in this list? So let me just tell you a little about them. Maybe you know them well, maybe you don't. And as I run through their stories far too quickly, see if you can draw any connections between them, as to say, what is the significance of these four women? The tribe of Judah, the biggest, most powerful tribe in the nation of Israel, was named after a man named, you guessed it, Judah. Now, Judah was one of Joseph's brothers. Most of us, I hope, know the story of Joseph. So Judah is one of Joseph's brothers, just to give you a sense of context. And in Genesis chapter 38, the story of Joseph is in full swing. He's the promised child. He's thrown into, his brothers hate him. All this stuff happens. He goes down to Egypt. But in the middle of all of that, we have this story taking up the whole of chapter 38. The story of Judah's daughter-in-law, Tamar. Now, she was probably a Canaanite, we're not told, but most likely a Canaanite who married Judah's son. His name was Ur. Now, Ur died, leaving Tamar a widow and childless. And so Judah had a responsibility as the father, as the head of the household, head of the clan. Judah had a responsibility to provide Tamar with a son, and preferably with a husband. There were provisions in culture and then later in the Mosaic law where if a woman died without child, if a woman's husband died without her having a child, that his brother was responsible for giving her an heir. And so Judah was responsible for arranging this. And preferably even providing her with one of his sons as a husband. But Judah didn't do this. Instead, he sends Tamar back to her family and to her father and left her there in shame. And so eventually Tamar, being neglected, being just sort of forgotten, dresses as a prostitute, tricks Judah himself into sleeping with her and giving her twin sons. Now you think that, oh, she's forgotten back there with her father, but oh, when she becomes pregnant, now Judah's very upset. He's ready to kill her until she demonstrates that he is the father, he himself is the father of her children. And so it's a messy story. It's not in most children's Bible storybooks. We don't talk about it a whole lot upstairs either, right? That's Tamar. Then there's Rahab. Joshua 2, chapter 2 and verse 1 introduces her right at the beginning as a prostitute. Like that was who she was. Like she's Rahab, the prostitute. She's a Canaanite living in the city of Jericho who assists the Israelite spies. And in return, she and her family are spared death when the city is conquered. She's good to the spies. Israel's good to her. And with her home destroyed along with the rest of Jericho, she joins the Israelite camp and lives among them as a follower of Yahweh. Rahab in a nutshell. Ruth was also a Gentile, born and raised east of the Dead Sea in the nation of Moab. Ruth married an Israelite. When he died, Ruth traveled to Israel with her mother-in-law, Naomi. She eventually marries Boaz, a relative of her late husband, similar to what Tamar went through, where she's like, I need a son, and the family has a responsibility to arrange that. So Boaz was a relative that had a responsibility to, in this case, marry her and provide her with children. In time, she became, if there's no gaps there in the genealogy, she became the great-grandmother of King David. So Ruth has a book of the Bible named after her. And lastly, we're introduced to Bathsheba, or as Matthew describes her, the woman who had been Uriah's wife. And we don't know much about Bathsheba's family. She may have been an Israelite, but she married a Hittite, joining his family. His name was Uriah. King David saw her, slept with her. Maybe I should throw in there, used his power to sleep with her. Killed her husband, married her, buried her child. And then together they had Solomon, who succeeded David as king of Israel, even though he wasn't David's eldest son. Four women, each highlighted by Matthew as an ancestor of Jesus. But why? Why these four? Maybe you've connected some dots of your own. Several theories exist. First one is that throughout his ministry, Jesus consistently gives women more respect than the culture that he moved amongst. And so Matthew may be highlighting this, saying, from the very beginning, let me highlight the importance of women in God's kingdom and God's plan for his kingdom. Perhaps the second idea is that Rahab and Ruth, we know, were definitely Gentiles. Tamar, I'm going to say, probably was. Bathsheba probably wasn't, but married a Gentile. And so perhaps we look at this list and we see this connection with Gentiles and amongst these women. Obviously, the men could not be Gentiles if they were going to be a continuous chain of continuity to Abraham, between Abraham and Jesus. So the men could not be Gentiles, and so Matthew may highlight these women and their Gentile connections as a way of showing that Jesus' ministry was going to expand beyond the borders of Israel and throughout the world, including the Gentiles. A third idea, and I guess it's possible for all of these to be correct, right? Third idea, I feel like I'm playing Boulder Dash again, if you will, is that Matthew is seeking to diminish Mary's shame at being an unwed mother by highlighting prominent women in Jesus' history who also had questionable sexual backgrounds. And I think that's the one that I've probably heard the most. The problem with it, though, is that it's questionable how much shame Mary would have experienced. Now, I think it's easy for us to say, if there's a unwed mother in our church, then here's the level of shame that she would experience. And say, therefore, Mary in her village would experience the same. But our church and Mary's village are not the same place, right? And so Mary, as you'll recall, was betrothed to Joseph. This was a legally binding arrangement in Jewish culture. All that awaited the couple was the wedding. All the contracts had been made, the agreements had been entered into, the families were connected. And so there's certainly later rabbinical teaching that really approves of sexual intercourse before marriage between people who were betrothed to each other. And so even if that doesn't apply here, it's still a different, not the same level of shame as we might expect in our culture, in our context today. What would be a problem in their culture is if the father of the child was not Joseph. Now, Joseph knows that the father of the child is not Joseph, right? So there's still a problem. But everyone else in the village assumes that it's Joseph, right? That would be a natural assumption for them to make. And we see from the way that Mary moves, goes to the wedding, that she, the influence she has in Jesus' life as she moves amongst the crowd throughout his ministry, that it doesn't seem as though she is typecast as somebody who is on the margins of that society, of that community, as a person of shame. She seems to just fit in fairly well. And so I believe that a better explanation than sort of paving the way for Mary's shame by giving examples of other shameful women. A better explanation is that they represent not a heritage of outsiders, of Gentiles, not a heritage of sinners or a heritage of shame, but rather they represent a heritage of faith in Jesus' lineage. One commentator summarized it this way. He said, when we look at these names, what we see is this contrast between Israel's unfaithfulness and these women who are outsiders or do have some, certainly they have a history, but it's their faith that is emphasized. Tamar versus Judah's disloyalty. Okay. Judah behaved unhonorably towards her. okay, without honor. Rahab versus the desert generations of Israel versus their faithlessness. Ruth versus the unfaithful Israelites at the time of the judges. And Uriah versus David's sinfulness with Bathsheba. The messianic line was preserved even through Gentiles, when Israel was unfaithful. God accomplished his purpose through them. And so I've given this Christmas series the title God Unshackled. As we close out the year on our 2017 theme, Faith Unshackled. In many ways, it's a strange name for a series, as we might legitimately ask, how could God ever be shackled? Who could ever tie up God? And so I want to use this series of the next 4 weeks, today and three more, to suggest that many times we're the ones who tie up God because our faith in God is too small. Rather than our faith being unshackled and without limits and living a life of freedom, I want to suggest that many times our faith is restricted and small. And what's fascinating is that there is a correlation between our faith and our understanding of God. The smaller our faith, the smaller God is. And conversely, the larger, the greater, the stronger our faith, the stronger and larger our God is. And so reflecting on these four women, I wonder how you characterize them. By race? By reputation? As marginalized people with little power and influence in their society? Or did you see them as oppressed by those who had power and influence in their society? What we see in them says something about how we see the world and perhaps about how we see people around us today. But when we step back and when we look at these women as God does, we only see women of faith. It's interesting because we want to talk about how we give people a new start. How we see them for what they've become, and yet it's hard for Rahab to stop being Rahab the prostitute, isn't it? Even today. God sees them as strong women standing up for themselves and trusting their futures to God. And so the manger that we so often look at this time of year prompts us to ask the question, who is this child? Who is the child in the manger? Is it simply a peasant baby that became a phenomena, a cultural, social phenomena? Or is it actually the Creator God in human form, helpless in a manger, to a young mother and a father who's never been a father before? And so the manger challenges our faith and asks us a very important question. But Matthew, before he gets to the manger, asks another question about our faith. He says, how do you see the people around you? What do you see when you look around your society? What is your attitude toward the oppressed? What is your attitude towards the disadvantaged? Do you see other people's race as a barrier? You may not call them Gentiles, but do you still draw a point of distinction between you and them? Or can you look past all of this and can you see people who are needing, people who are seeking, and people who are serving God? Do you recognize faith when it's right in front of you? Do you see Tamar as a woman of faith? Do you see Rahab as a woman of faith? Perhaps Ruth, because she has a book named after her. Do you see Bathsheba as a woman of faith, or is she always that woman that tripped David up? Is she better known as David's mistress than as Solomon's mother? How do we see Bathsheba? How do we see these people who are in our midst, whose stories we know, whose pasts we know, perhaps whose stories we don't know, but whose stories we write for them because they're dressed in a particular way, because they come from a particular part of town, because they speak a particular way, and so we write their stories for them and we say, this is who you are. And we treat them as though that's who they are. Because the women that are in Jesus' genealogy shouldn't be remembered for their sexual scandals, but for their faith in overcoming those scandals. And then the important point is that God responds to their faith with unlimited mercy. You see, when God is unshackled, then whatever God does is unlimited. You see, we're the ones that put restraints on God. We're the ones that say, no, God, you can't show mercy to them. God, you can't forgive them. God, you can't make that law. God, you can't do this. God, if He's unshackled, if we allow God to be God, has unlimited mercy. Amen. Towards those that we may want to draw a circle around. Just a few weeks ago, on social media, the hashtag MeToo became an overnight cultural phenomenon. As many women and some men acknowledged that they'd been sexually abused. And so people would just post on their Facebook wall, on Twitter, just the words, MeToo. They didn't have to go into details, but it was just a way of saying, I'm part of that group of people, that large group of people that have been sexually abused at some point in my life. And the goal was to raise awareness. The goal was to remind us of the statistics, of the numbers of women, of people who have survived that. And since then, we've seen women finding the courage to speak up against many prominent men. You know the names. You know the faces. They've lost jobs, mostly at this point in film and television. But often the victims of sexual abuse have held their voices for years because of the fear that no one will believe them. Because of fear that they will experience shame or have shame placed upon them. Perhaps they'll have blame placed upon them. And even in churches, men with positions, friends, and influence make it difficult for victims to believe that their voices will be heard. And so amongst us, we have people posting on their walls, not that I'm picking out on anyone or thinking of anyone, me too. Perhaps it's a social media wall, perhaps it's just the wall of your heart and you're saying me too. And church isn't the safe place to raise your hand to that. And so these four names in a list of 50 thereabouts have an important message for us. God responds to their faith with mercy. Despite the rumors, the stories, the whispers that went around the palace, that went around the wheat field, that went around the camp regarding these four women, God responded to their faith with mercy. And there's no need for shame. And I can't promise that every Christian will look at every person and see only faith, not mistakes. I can't promise that when God, I can promise that when God looks over the span of history, He's not looking for failures. He's looking for faith. And so in Hebrews 11, the great chapter of faith, right in there between Moses and Joshua, Gideon, Barak, and Samson, we find Rahab in verse 31. And perhaps it seems cruel because even there she's listed as Rahab the prostitute. But the point isn't that she had a past. She's there because of her faith. She's there because of the changes that she made, because of how God saw her. And so how do you see the world? What do you see in a person first? Their faith and their courage? Or their past? Their failures? And so I think there's a challenge for us who've aligned ourselves with God that we see people the way that God sees people. That we see their faith and their relationship with God before we see their failures. But maybe today faith hasn't been part of your life. Perhaps you look in the mirror and you see only failure. And so in Matthew chapter 1, as God reviews Jesus' ancestry, as he prepares to sign Jesus' birth certificate, he encourages us to accept his mercy. And so we tie God's hands when we say that we're too messed up. We limit God's unlimitless mercy when we say that we're too damaged for God to want us. The manger, empty at this point in the story, still speaks to us of God's unshackled mercy. Mary, when she knew she was with child, didn't mourn. Instead, she celebrates in Luke. As was read for us, God raises up the humble. He raises up Rahab. He raises up Tamar. He raises up Ruth. And he raises up Bathsheba. And he brings down the men. He brings down those who are in power. He brings down the mighty. Because he's looking for faith, not failure. And because he has mercy on those who have failed. And so my question today is, will you accept it? Will you accept God's mercy? Will you start a new life of faith today, living with God and living for God? If there is any part of your life that needs mercy, that needs encouragement, that needs your faith to grow, then we would love to pray with you. We're going to sing a song and you can come and let me know about that. If you have hurts that you've kept to yourself, if you see yourself in those women and you say, my failure is still hurting me, not that it's even your failure, that's in so many ways that's the wrong word to apply to those women. My hurt, my damage that's been done to me, it's so overwhelming at times. My faith needs to grow. I encourage you to find someone you can trust that's a Christian, that you can share that story with, that you can be encouraged, and if that's where you're at in your life. You don't have to do it in front of the whole church. But get the help, get the encouragement and the support that you need. You don't have to go through life feeling shame alone, because God's grace, love, and mercy is greater than any shame that other people or the Satan wants to lay upon us. Let's stand and sing together.